So, Glenn, what I want to start with is just to, I'm about to make a terrible book pun, get everyone on the same page, briefly remind us about the story of Cynthia Ann Parker. Her story is a true story. It was turned into a novel, which was turned into the film. So we've kind of got some layers rolling in on themselves here. But remind us about Cynthia Ann Parker and her story.
Well, it begins as a pretty simple story of a 9-year-old girl in East Texas, where Grosbeck is now, who her family has settled the area around there. They've got a large fortified settlement, extended family. And then one day in May 1836, Comanches and other Native Americans sort of swoop down. They raid the place. They kill 5 men, including Cynthia Ann's father and grandfather, and they abduct 5 young people, including Cynthia Ann, and ride off to Comancheria. And she spends the next 24 years as a Comanche. She's kind of a little bit legendary in her, you know, in that period, the sort of white Comanche princess, but there are very few sightings of her. She gets a husband eventually and 3 children. And then in 1860, 24 years later, she's recaptured in a raid by Texas Rangers and U.S. Cavalry and restored to her white family.
And what happened to her just briefly when she was restored to her family?
Well, you know, her family was expecting her to be grateful for being restored and returned to Christendom and all of that. But in fact, she's crushed. She's got her little girl with her when she's recaptured, but her 2 sons are not there. So you can imagine what this is like, having been abducted by strangers speaking a strange language who kill the people around her and haul her off when she's 9 years old. It happens a second time, and she is traumatized. She can't adjust to being back in the white world. She's kind of a celebrity for a while. They take her to the legislature. They kind of show her, display her at Fort Worth. But eventually they become very embarrassed by her family, because it's clear that she is desperately unhappy. And then we lose track of her. There's no obituary of Cynthia Ann. She dies probably around 1870, 1871, but already the legend's been forming. You know, she died of a broken heart, or, you know, she loved her, you know, she became a Christian again. All these kinds of stories get told, but the real story is very, very hard to track down.
Well, so why did you want to look back into both her story and then the story of the making of the film about her story?
Well, I kind of started, you know, as I usually do, from, you know, the wrong end. I started from the movie, because I always loved the movie. It's one of those iconic movies. I saw it as a kid. I saw it in college. I'm not the only one, incidentally. Steven Spielberg and George Lucas and Martin Scorsese saw it when they were growing up.
Yeah, you're in good company there.
Yeah, very good company, you know. And so I thought I was going to maybe just do a book about the making of this wonderful movie, because there really hadn't been a book about that. But the minute you start pulling back the string a little bit, it's a captivity narrative. And of course, those are such, you know, embroidered into the American fabric. They're really our first literary genre. So when I started pulling back the string, I very quickly got back to Cynthia Ann, to her Comanche surviving son, Quanah, to this wonderful, rich, original story. And so at that point, I decided somehow I'm going to make these two parts hang together. They fit with each other. What's that really about? And of course, that's why it took 6 years to get it done.
Now talk a little bit about the process. Then what did you have to do to research these sort of these two parallel, but related stories?
Well, I spent a lot of time in archives to begin with. And, you know, I hadn't done a book in 10 years. So, you know, suddenly I have all these tools of the internet age. I'm at Stanford University for a while. Then I'm at the University of Texas. It's like Rip Van Winkle suddenly waking up to see all this great stuff. So you can find the archives, and then you go physically and you visit them, whether you're doing, you know, for the Hollywood part, I went down to Los Angeles. I went to UCLA, where the papers of Alan LeMay, the novelist who wrote The Searchers, there are 23 boxes at UCLA, the Warner Brothers archives. You know, I was just floating in archives. John Ford's papers are all at Indiana University, where his grandson deposited them. So partly it was that. But then it was a big trip to Texas. We stopped in Monument Valley on the way and saw where Ford filmed the movie. But then we got to Texas, which I got to tell you, doesn't look a whole lot like Monument Valley. endless archives there. But not only that, the sites, the actual sites where these events occurred, where Cynthia Ann was kidnapped, where she was recaptured along the Pease River, you know, in northeast Texas, Oklahoma, where Quanah Parker's original home, the Star House, still exists, Palo Duro Canyon. I mean, it became a real adventure for us. And it's lovely, you know. as a writer, it's very important to be able to see things. And there still is a lot to see. You have to use your imagination, of course. You have to understand the events going on. But it's so helpful to be able to go to these actual places, measure the distances, feel the weather. And so it was a 360-degree experience.
So you're floating in archives, you're visiting the site, seeing where these events took place. What did you learn new, or what kind of bubbled up for you about Cynthia Ann's story and also about the film?
Well, in the case of Cynthia Ann, one of the best places to go happens to be just down the street from where we're talking now. The Briscoe Center for American History has what's called the Tallman Papers, which the Tallmans were cousins, distant cousins, and they compiled all this family history, not only about Cynthia Ann and Quanah, but about the entire saga of the Parkers, which goes back to 16th century England and continues on today. And scattered in those boxes, well, you get the files with the sort of traditional story of, you know, brave, you know, young woman and the sort of macho version, if you will, of the men rescuing her. But also there are other accounts there. They're not well annotated. You got to find them. A couple of relatives of Cynthia Ann, including her first cousin, a woman named Susan Parker St. John, came down and did some what I would call reporting. Talk to relatives, talk to friends. Susan was compiling a family history that she hoped to publish. She never did, but her handwritten notes are in two or three boxes at Briscoe, scattered among other things, and they give a much more poignant portrait of Cynthia Ann and what she was up against. And there are a few other gems located here and there, and it's quite lovely to see that. Then for the movie, I mean, it's partly going back at these various archives and papers. There are still a few surviving members of the cast. I was able to talk to Harry Carey Jr. before his death a few weeks ago. I talked to him in 2009, Pippa Scott. You know, Dan Ford is John Ford's grandson, and Dan did a lovely memoir of his grandfather many years ago, and he was incredibly helpful. So I was able to do some reporting of the kind I'm used to doing, really interviewing people. But at the same time, if you work long enough and hard enough in the archives, you always find a little of this and that. There's still many mysteries about the making of the movie. It seems like Ford might have filmed two endings, one in Monument Valley, and then he decided he didn't like that one, so he filmed another one. Ford left very few written notes about the decisions he made and why he did things. So there are some things that just can't be resolved. But, you know, I feel like I came as close as anybody could at this point.
So the film has become kind of an iconic film. You studied it. You loved it. It has influenced and inspired many well-known directors. What is it about the film that is so special and has made it sort of so important?
It's on a couple of levels, I think. First of all, it's just visually so beautiful. It's visual poetry. John Ford was one, you know, he wasn't the inventor of the Western movie genre, but he was the one who really took it to its highest level. And this is a mature work of a 60-year-old man who has a lot to say. And he also, we're in this beautiful setting. We're in VistaVision and Technicolor, and so it looks gorgeous. And Ford has an unerring sense of telling the story visually. The only real way to compare it is to look at the shooting script versus what's actually on the screen. And you can see that he's ripping out dialogue and exposition and explanations and giving you instead visual clues. And you have to make up your mind. And so part of it is that the movie has a lot of ambiguity in it that the viewer has to resolve. And I think that helps raise it to cinematic art. But also, it's what the movie is about. It's about this incredible struggle of Comanches and Texans and the sort of human price for that and questions of race and gender, because Ford takes the original story of this little girl who becomes a Comanche, who marries a Comanche, in other words, who has sex with Indians, which is the great, forbidden, scary thing for settlers. And Ford raises it right up to the top of the narrative, the uncle who is searching for Cynthia Ann in the film, played beautifully by John Wayne, is searching to get her, not to restore her to her family, but he's actually planning to kill her because over the course of time, she's becoming a young woman, she's married a Comanche, this is an honor killing, and that narrative tension both drives the story and makes you want to know what's going to happen, but at the same time, it provides yet another deep level of understanding of what this is. Ford gives us this wonderful John Wayne character, you know, this charismatic leader of men, but at the same time, he makes him into a bit of a psychopath. And it's that thing that I think has really appealed to a lot of people over the years, that sort of double vision that Ford has that makes this a much deeper work than your average Western.
Now, I'm assuming when it came out, though, it wasn't viewed that way, that this has been more of an evolution over time of people studying and looking at it. Because I think originally everybody kind of just bought the myth of the story.
Yeah, it's amazing. When you go back and read the reviews, it got pretty good reviews and it finished number 11 in the box office. But it was seen as just like a pretty good John Wayne cowboy and Indian movie. Nobody seemed to get it. And it's only over time and changing sensibility that people have read more deeply into it. And, you know, that's part of what my book's about, too. I think every generation comes along, takes these kinds of basic fundamental stories, you know, captivity narrative, the abduction of a young girl, and they read into it their own sensibility and they change the parts they don't like so much and they, you know, tell it again. And that's really, and that's how a legend is formed. That's how we explain the founding of America and the conquest of the American West to ourselves and who we are really through these kinds of stories. And that's exactly the process that, you know, that I'm trying to trace.
Does it matter that, you know, there's a story of Cynthia Ann Parker, there's the novel, there's the movie. None of the versions match up exactly. We don't really know what happened. I mean, when push comes to shove, it can't be determined with certainty. Does that really matter that we don't know the true story?
Yes, it matters, I say, as a journalist and as a nonfiction writer. But it's not that, and I tried to find out as much of the truth as I could, but I wouldn't even begin to pretend that this is the last word of the truth with a capital T about any of this. This is our version, my version, if you will, in 2013, using my sensibility and my attempt to go back at it. There have been many versions before, as you say, you know, the film, the novel, the movie, you know, all these things, and there'll be more to come, I'm sure. So this is, but yes, I do believe in truth. I do believe in at least trying to sift out so that we can pin things that we know aren't true. And then the next person will come along and hopefully do a better job.
I mean, you're a journalist and a journalism teacher. Was it frustrating that there are some things about this that are just never, can't be nailed down?
You know, on one level, maybe a little frustrating, but on another level, that's who we are. I mean, that's what life's like. I used to not say this to people, but I say it now. You know, if we get 50% of it right on the first day of a breaking story of a violent event, I think we're actually doing pretty well. We have to keep coming back at things. And in journalism, I wasn't known for being really good at breaking stories. What I tried to do was go back at the stuff that we already thought we knew and to point out the things that we didn't know. And I guess you could say I've carried that over into this book. I mean, so no, it's not frustrating. That's life. I mean, that's who we are. We're always taking facts that we do know and we're embroidering them and we're changing them and we're reading things into them that we never would have read into them when they actually happened. That's just the nature of mankind.
In doing the research and the traveling and everything that you did for this book, what was the thing that surprised you most or kind of got your attention the most? Because, I mean, as you say, this is a really compelling story. Whatever it is that we do know about it, even just kind of the bare bones story is pretty compelling. And then the movie and the making of the movie, what really stood out for you in all of this?
That's a really good question. There were so many moments. Finding Alan LeMay, for example, of whom there isn't even a photo online of this guy, and there's just a couple of paragraphs, and actually finding his family and seeing the first picture that I'd ever seen of Alan LeMay, who wrote this wonderful novel that became the basis of the movie, was a really inspiring moment in a way. I think the other thing, though, was in looking for John Ford, in searching for John Ford. John Ford cut his films in the camera as he was making them. There are not a lot of outtakes. He didn't write down very many notes. Unlike Alfred Hitchcock, he didn't do storyboards. It was all in his head. And in the end, it was so frustrating on one level until I recognized the only way I'm going to figure out what he was doing is look at that final script and then look at the movie itself and look at the differences. And there, in those changes, in those decisions that he made, that's the essence of John Ford and his artistry. So when I finally relaxed about it and just tried to watch it, and I listened, Peter Bogdanovich does a wonderful, you know, narrative of the film, explanation in one of the DVDs, that sort of thing. Then I began to see that Ford actually was showing us who he was and what he'd done, even though he never articulated it.
Can you enjoy watching the movie?
Now that you know,
but you know all this stuff. I mean, can you watch it and just kind of sit back and watch it?
I love the movie. I mean, it still makes me cry. When I watch the movie, David Thompson, the film critic, said this once, I'm not sure how it's going to end because it's that exciting and it's that unsettling that, you know, it's always a revelation. And I cry at the end of the movie. I mean, I always have and I always will because ultimately it's about the sort of triumph of love and restoration over this hatred. And to me, that's such a rich thing. So, yeah, I've got no problem watching it.
Glenn Frankel is the author of The Searchers, The Making of an American Legend. He's also the director of the School of Journalism here at UT Austin. And Glenn, we thank you so much for your time today.
Well, this was great. Thanks for having me.
Well, that was wonderful.